The bird song at Severn Beach Railway Station is as loud as the actual trains. A few times a day, a couple of stubby carriages creep along the single track, bump up against the end of the line just short of the beach, release a few passengers, and then sidle back to Bristol.
Hello!
Writer Noreen Masood, whose memoir A Flat Place has been nominated for several of the top literary prizes, has chosen Severn Beach for our walk because, no surprise here, it's a flat place. The beach is deserted, with an air of quiet surprise that it was ever called the Blackpool of the West. The beach is more mud than sand, which is a good thing if you're Noreen, because she's a compulsive digger for bones, fossils and stones. The dark, silty clay seems to promise more mysterious, even alarming treasures than the perky lemon sand of Bournemouth or Bognor might.
So I found a few things. First is this. So I used to know somebody who loved grey rocks with a white line on. And I think the white line is just another kind of rock that's rushed in to fill the gap. I don't know why the gaps are caused, but I always find them very beautiful for that reason. It reminds me of the HD poem, The Pool, which ends with the line, "What are you, banded one?" Banded one. Oh, again, perhaps that's the horizontal line of the flat landscape, that band, that kind of line that cuts itself across something without apology. But I found two of those. I found one that's made white lines into a kind of V shape, and one where the white line is right round this rock, and stands out a little bit in a sort of relief. I've got a great fondness for that kind of rock, where the band feels... But I have lots of them, so I'm not taking that one. Not allowed to. This one, I think, is a sort of... It's a sedimentary rock, so it's a kind of composite of lots of little rocks all stuck together. What I'm interested in is whether one of them is a fossil. Looking up close, I don't think it is, but, you know, I think things that look like they might be bones are pretty much as interesting as things that are bones. There's a little nub of something that...
You're quite fussy about which bones you dig up, because I...
Yes. And
there's a moment in the book where you're captivated by some bird bones, and then you think, actually, it looks like there might still be some organs attached.
Yes.
It's too recent a death, and you decide not to hoik it out of this little place.
And part of that's practical, of course. Like, I'm not necessarily going to be allowed into a hostel if I've got a sort of reeking bag of rotting flesh with me. But yeah, part of it is about what I can, you know, like I don't have the expertise necessarily to process a bone that's still got meat attached to it. There's, you know, I'm quite good at degreasing bones which don't have flesh attached, but it's just a different sort of process.
Noreen's strange, mysterious memoir is an unpredictable thing. Just when you think you've understood that for someone with complex post-traumatic stress disorder, like Noreen, flat places are soothing, unsurprising, and capacious. A flat place morphs into a state of mind in which Noreen is flat, her mind is flat, her mood is flat. Flatness is a constantly mutating force here. Noreen tells of her isolated childhood in Lahore, sharing a bedroom with her three sisters and mother. Her mother slept on cushions. And being fenced in on the first floor behind bars and chicken wire. As many as 25 people might be living in the house at any one time. Noreen's father, a doctor, is a frightening presence, and a sense of that constant threat seeps from the book's pages. He professed not to mind that he had daughters, but if girls were what he had, he would make them the best, most productive of girls.
He was determined to optimise us, mentally and physically. My medical records start at the age of 16, when I moved to the UK and registered with a doctor for the first time. Until then, my father did everything, as my mother held us, or held us down. It was all part of competing with the imaginary boys. I don't know what all those injections were throughout my childhood. They usually happened quite unexpectedly. My father arriving home with a briefcase of vials and needles, ordering my mother to get us ready as he filled the syringes. Nor can I explain the heaps of tablets arranged next to my plastic mug of buffalo milk at breakfast and dinner. I never asked. I can't remember if I even thought of asking. Questions didn't tend to end in answers. But I do know, because my father bragged about it often, that there was nothing he couldn't get hold of if he wanted. All he had to do, he told us, was pick up the phone. And I know that when my father decided that my little sister, forget-me-not, was too short, he simply began injecting her with growth hormone. I remember forget-me-not, aged perhaps 10, standing in the middle of the living room, staring at nothing with her mouth slightly open, while my father hunched over her arm. I looked away, then let my mind spread and flatten. I began to go to a place where everything was present and nothing was knowable, and the sky arched high above us all.
Noreen describes her complex PTSD as what happens when you're born into a world shaped by a world where there's no safety ever, when the people who should take care of you are instead scary and unreliable, and when you live years and years without the belief that escape is possible. Like a flat place, she says, complex PTSD is hard to decipher because it doesn't offer a significant landmark. But then, as a young teenager, Noreen, her sisters and mother, are suddenly and brutally banished from Pakistan by her father, and they flee to Scotland. We're never told precisely why he does this, although there are clues and hints. But then, this is a deliberately flat book. There are no easy peaks or troughs of suspense and revelation. Just a strange, uncanny flatness, where even the moments of shock are delivered in Noreen's calm, considered, curious prose. She soothes herself by flattening her life, turning her back on the landscapes of wild romantic poets and ambitious mountaineers with their craggy outcrops and peaks to conquer. She travels from Ely to the Fens to Orford Ness, Newcastle Moor, Morecambe Bay and Orkney, all the flat places, and always on the lookout for fossils and bones to dig up.
I love collecting bones because I'm very interested in what it means to be a living thing and what it means to be a dead thing and to make that transition from one stage to another. And fossils are a lovely borderline between the bone and the stone. And I have a little fossil of a sea star in my house, which is 150 million years old. And I just can't get my head around it. I can contemplate it forever because I'll never be able to understand that time scale or the fact that this little twisting sea star, you can see the limbs twisting in the moment of its freezing. How that was ever alive and how it can still be here now. So the object I brought with me today is one that I found during a walk that I describe in A Flat Place. It's the walk that I took with my friend on Shingle Street in Suffolk, just a little way away from Orford Ness, that I describe in detail. And I talk about the Shingle Street walk in the book. This object is a mermaid's purse, also known as the egg sac of a dogfish or shark. This one is empty and it's got a little bit of a slit in it. And you can hear it's quite light and it creates this kind of almost papery, it's almost like card. It's a funny thing, it looks like it's leather but it feels like paper. Or actually like something that's come from a tree. What am I thinking of here? It feels more like bark than it does a sea thing.
It's this extraordinary shape because it's got a kind of mattress-like look.
Yes!
It also looks as though it's like a miniature rucksack with its straps decayed.
Absolutely.
About the right size for a rat or something.
That's exactly it. It looks like a rat's backpack because it's got these flat sort of protrusions at all four corners of this kind of mostly oblong with round sides. And then it's kind of bulges in the middle. And that bulge is where the dogfish baby would be. This one's black, but I think it's the sharks ones that are transparent. And those are amazing because when they're alive, you can see the little embryo moving inside them. And this one has the crack in it because I think the little dogfish has hatched and got away, I like to think, not died in the case. this sat on the dashboard as we made our way home from Shingle Street to, at that time, Newcastle. I love it.
You mention in the book, and you've just cited it, in fact, your interest in bones. Mm. Bones come up a lot. There's a wonderful moment at the end of the book where there's a sort of rapprochement between you and your mother as she, too, starts to look for bones with you. And it's a very touching moment because there has been this strange sort of unspoken gulf between you as you ask her why it was that she didn't step in to protect you from bizarre moments in your childhood. But this jointly looking for a clavicle and a wing bone is very beautifully executed in the book. You also talk about bones being that kind of transitional thing that is the kind of scaffolding around which the meat is built, and the meat then becomes a person who laughs and jokes and tells stories and has friends. Is that something that you fully understood in yourself, that love for bones, or is it still one of those strange puzzling things, a bit like your description of a creature that's both alive and the next minute is dead, and you can't imagine that transitional moment?
So for me it's still a kind of puzzle, because I still don't really know. I don't have it resolved to my satisfaction on a day-to-day basis what a human being is, and how this transition between life and death can happen, and how we could be sitting here and there being and appalling genocidal acts being conducted on the other side of the world. I cannot reconcile those things, and that really settles to me as a dilemma in the body of the human being. Like, that's, you know, what makes a human being different from an animal? What makes a living thing different from one that is dead? What makes a valuable body different from a devalued or a dismissed body? And this sort of like leans into all kinds of questions about kind of race and gender and sexuality. What is a valuable body, and what is a body that can be dismissed or discarded? You know, which lives matter? How human beings are the most precious, important things in the world, and I do passionately believe that. And yet all we are is a kind of structure of bone covered in meat. I'm fascinated by that. I'll never understand it. It crystallised for me in the book with my father's death, I think, where for a long time, you know, he hadn't been very much in my mind, or he'd been on my mind in a kind of abstract way. Like, I'd gone through a year of talking about him quite a lot, I suppose, to somebody I was in love with, and trying to explain what he was like, what my childhood had been like, and finding that very difficult and feeling more and more unwell. And then he died in August, I think, of that year. And he ceased in that moment to be abstract and became concrete. He became physical, because now he was a body. He was a lump. He was a physical thing, rather than, as human beings are, always sort of magically moving between the cerebral and the emotional and the physical. And the physical is something we don't quite acknowledge as part of human beings, or it's kind of second best to the mind or the impact that you have more broadly. And then suddenly in the moment of death, you become physical. And in that moment of becoming physical, he became present to me in a way that was very frightening, because he had been very present to me when I was a young child, and he was a physically frightening presence, a dominant presence. And then when he died, he was stripped of all power, but that fear came back. And I hated the thought of him being in the earth, him being present in the world in this new way. And I wanted him gone. I wanted him rotted. I wanted him reduced to bones. I wanted the bones gone. And that became a preoccupation of mine for a moment, that sense of those bones living on and me being powerless to help the fact that I had to share the world with them, that we had to be in the world at the same time.
This is the exact obverse of what people would expect, which is that when a frightening person dies, and actually they are negated, that
Precisely.
They evaporate.
Yep.
And actually he became so much more solid, to the extent that you then researched with a forensic scientist how long it would take for his body to decay in the ground.
Yep.
I don't know what the reaction of the scientist was, but she must have been rather puzzled as to why you wished to know what was the timescale, what was the timetable.
I didn't necessarily tell her a complete version of the truth about why I wanted to know these things. I didn't feel I could explain that, and I can't really explain it to myself, because as you say, it's an unusual reaction. It's not one that's immediately comprehensible to people. And when my mother read that part of the book, she was quite shocked, I think. Now I live alone with the things I love. Some of them are living and some aren't. My plants, my cat, but also my collection of stones, the things I have dug up which last and last. The sheep skull I found at the edge of a field, one cow vertebra. One stone shaped like a cow vertebra. They sit together on the bookcase, the real and the imposter. I like bones because they speak to a basic problem of mine, that human beings are at once living, thinking, laughing creatures, and also skeletons covered in dense marbled meat. In my efforts to understand that, people make less and less sense to me. So I collect bones because I like knowing what everyone looks like inside. I remember watching my friends play Go at university, and how, when no one was looking, I quietly popped a single white Go piece into my mouth, its smooth hardness against my tongue and my palate. Where language fails, where human connection stalls, objects help. Hard china, cold metal, shells and bones, things I can rub on my face, tap against my teeth, balance on my fingertip. And it's not just beautiful or interesting things. In my fruit bowl there is an ugly chunk of wood and a seed case covered with prickles which catches my finger every time I reach for an orange, making the hair on the back of my neck rise. I can't throw them away because I love them. To me they're bristling with indignant, fascinating life. They live in my house like roommates, and we don't always get on, but that's how it is. I prefer them to human company. With human beings, your attention can't ebb and flow. You have to be fully present all the time until your eyes blur and your back hurts and a lump rises in your throat. With a plant or a cat or a stone, you can be there for a while, go away, come back.
We trudge on through the gritty, slithery mud towards the soaring architectural ambition that is the Severn Bridge, eyes always ready to spot a decent bone or stone. You might think that Noreen has written a nature book. Go into any bookshop and there'll be a table piled with nature writing, often of the self-medicating, soothing kind. But, ever original, Noreen isn't interested in that kind of book at all.
I'm a terrible nature writer. I'm not even particularly interested in the question of whether I am a nature writer or not, I guess. But like, what I know about myself is that I have no sense of direction, and I don't really know very much about anything. I'm not a nature expert. I don't have expertise in any of the kind of animals or stones or anything that one might encounter. And the kind of rhythm of nature writing is often the kind of personal experience, then sort of deep dive into information. And I don't have information. And or else nature writing involves being kind of, very often you've got this trope that the nature writer will meet some kind of knowledgeable local guide who will take them into spaces that no one else can access. And again, I'm not interested in having experiences no one else can. I'm not interested in exclusivity, that bores me. I'm interested in really what happens when you go to a space with no knowledge, no expertise and no special opportunities. Yeah, that's what interests me.
It's funny because that almost describes how you are about yourself. And if you're doing a kind of archaeological dig upon yourself in this book, there's a puzzlement that you have about yourself throughout, as though you need to find a guide to yourself. Do you think, having written the book, that you've got a clearer sense of your own map?
Well, I think that what I was interested in, and we talked a little bit about bones, I think. I think my final conclusion about bones, really, because we have a great interest. If there are bones, if there's a secret, if there's something underground, we need to dig it up, right? We have to do the archaeological dig. But I just became increasingly interested. It's an idea from Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick. She says in one of her essays, if we knew that, what would we know that we don't already know? In other words, what does the revelation change? If we need to find the revelation, to an extent we already know it. And it doesn't add anything. So I'm very interested in the book in more making peace with what can never be known than finding things out or sort of naming things particularly. There are lots of things that remain unspecified in the book, unnamed, undiscovered. There's still so much I don't know and will never know because the people who knew it have died or can't access it for whatever reason. And that's the kind of nature, really, of complex PTSD, that you live alongside things that can never be known. So you never have that satisfaction. You never have that sense of rounding off.
Are there any moments when they can't be known because you don't wish to tell us?
Yes. Not don't wish to tell you, but it's not my story to tell. And I know that telling the story would cause great distress to someone currently alive who doesn't deserve to have distress caused to them. So I write I'm quite open about this in the book, that there is a hole in the middle of the story. There's a story that I can't tell. And that was a great difficulty for a long time, because in traditional narrative patterns, that event it looks like the turning point of my story, quote unquote. You know, because that was the event that precipitated my father disowning us and us moving to Britain. And the clues are there.
if anyone's, you know, there are clues enough in the book for people to make a decent guess if they were interested in that. But yes, so because I too couldn't tell that story, I thought, how can I write this book? Because it isn't a story without the turning point. Because all stories, if you think about traditional models of storytelling, you've got the kind of situation, then you can, I'm raising my hand up here, you've got the sort of the tension building and the climax, and then the resolution. And so with my finger I make a mountain, don't I? So I'm low down, I go up into the climax, and I go down again. So the kind of so how do you tell a story without a turning point event? What the story you have to tell is a flat story. It's a story. So the story that you tell is the story that has the same dilemma as a flat landscape. How do you look at it? How do you walk through it? How do you orientate yourself? So to become okay with a flat landscape and to know how to be in it or learn how to be in it is the same as, or it has an analogue with, knowing how to be inside a story that doesn't make narrative sense or that doesn't follow narrative rules.
Whatever the event was, and we can't be sure as readers, even if we do guess,
yeah,
it still results in this extraordinary, shocking moment when you're banished from Pakistan as, yeah, as a teenager, and you've never been back, and you never can go back. No. You don't even have a Pakistani passport
anymore. So my Pakistani
anymore.
Passport's expired and I can't get it renewed. Well, to get it renewed, I would need a signature either from my father or my husband. I'm a queer, unmarried woman, and my father is dead. And as somebody who's down as Muslim in my passport, I'd also need to sign a declaration stating that I, essentially, that I believe the Ahmadis are not Muslims. And the Ahmadis are a very, very persecuted group in Pakistan. Yeah, part of Pakistan's long post-colonial trauma about what it is and what it means to have an identity. Yeah, so I can't go back, and I won't.
Interesting that you cite a particular example of a persecuted group, because actually the more one reads the book, the more you are identifying persecuted groups, and it becomes this kind of examination of Britain's colonial past,
yeah,
and the effects of that colonisation, and you seem to get increasingly rageful. I think the first instance of it is when you go into a gift shop in Ely and you discover that there's a little packet of gollywogs,
yes,
for sale for £7 each.
Yes.
Somehow you know before you see, yep, them that they're going to be there. But
I
it all then coalesces,
yes,
around that.
It was absolutely extraordinary. I don't know what it is, whether it's a kind of, whether it was a sort of vibe I was getting from the proprietor, a look that he gave me when I came in, a kind of a stiffening. You don't know what these things are when you are racialized. But you get a sense of where you're not welcome, even if nothing is made explicit. And I got a sense of what sort of shop it was, what sort of person it was behind the counter, and so, yeah, I knew it.
And then, of course, you discover more and more examples of terrible things. So
yeah,
you go to Morecambe Bay, and the sand flats is where, notoriously, more than 20 cockle pickers, Chinese cockle pickers, drowned.
Yes.
And then you go to Newcastle and you find this extraordinary example.
Yep.
1929, this sort of exhibition was created in the park, and 100 Senegalese people,
yep,
were kind of herded into an enclosure,
yeah, the
human as an
zoo.
Exhibit.
Yes. And in all of these cases, this is the thing I really wanted to stress, in all of these cases I was not looking for them. I was looking for something completely different, and they were just there. They were just there, and largely, well, not in the Morecambe Bay is very broadly discussed. What's key there is that nothing has changed. That is an example of a revelation that changes nothing. Our food is still produced by forced labour, by trafficked labour, by underpaid refugees and migrants. Nothing has changed. The revelation has changed nothing again. But in the case of the Human Zoo in Newcastle, that is openly available knowledge which nobody wants to know. And it's that dilemma, which is the dilemma of a flat landscape. Things that are right there, spread out openly in front of you, but somehow people cannot or will not see them. That was interesting to me. That kind of, and I became really interested in the difference between the kinds of knowledge that people are desperate to have, they seek out. And Orfordness is a great example. I talk about this in the book. People always think, what really happened to Orfordness? What, you know, what are they hiding? What's really happening? And there's all sorts of conspiracy theories and that sort of knowledge people are desperate to have, but there are other kinds of knowledge that people do not want to know. And I'm thinking here about the kind of backlash to the National Trust's decision to include, for the first time, some extra information about, say, the histories of slavery that attach to properties. This is, and the backlash there's been towards that is astounding to me. These are just things that people do not want to know or think about. Yeah, what can one say? Yeah, speechless.
In terms of, well, the book is obviously called A Flat Place, but there are different incarnations of what it means to be flat.
Yeah.
And this is another interesting aspect for the reader. I think I said to you when I met you off the train that there's something... Well, let's turn around. Sorry, the wind is too annoying.
Sure.
I think I said this to you as you got off the train and I met you on the platform. That this is a book which demands our concentration, which is just the kind of book I like.
Aww.
You know, we have to do some labour for you as we read the book. We have to concentrate, not because it's opaque, but because it just expects it. It's got a sort of gravitas about it. And it's asking stuff, which
lovely.
As reader you then deliver. But one of those things is that flat places kind of shift. So the very first time that you try to explain to us what a flat place constitutes, it sounds like a place of refuge. These are the green fields that you see through the car window on your way to school in Pakistan.
Yeah.
And you crave to see them, crave to sort of feast your eyes on their greenness. And that sounds like, okay, flat places means calming places, rescuing
yeah.
places. But actually they become at times a signal of your inability to feel that you're a real person. Or they become the places which reflect the kind of flatness of mood that you feel.
Yeah.
How many different kind of incarnations of a flat place do you think there are?
I think so. This is the thing that I sort of wrestle with. And I think the answer to that is that flat places are both a comfort and a terror, because that is the nature of things that we love and cling to in this world. And so I'll come back to the phrase complex post-traumatic stress disorder. It's complex post-traumatic stress disorder and post-traumatic stress disorders in general, they are situations of where what one flees to is not necessarily what is safe or good, but what one knows. So what feels good and what is safe, what feels like a refuge versus what is a refuge, they're not necessarily the same thing. So a flat place is both a refuge and a place of terror. It is a in a flat place, I feel real, you know? And in today's world, in Britain today, in my really very nice life as an academic and in my lucky position getting to talk to people in the literary world and all of these things don't feel real to me. What feels real to me is fear and isolation. And sometimes one has to make that decision. Do you want to feel real or do you want to feel happy? And then there's a further dilemma. Because the underlying logic of the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder is that you are now safe. You weren't safe in the past, but you are now safe. But none of us are safe in this world. And particularly racialized people continue to be profoundly unsafe. We have this playing out at the moment in the world where people in Sudan and Gaza are in the most horrific situations. And the lives that are being lost are just not valued in the same way as white lives would be. How can I tell myself that I am safe now when I'm not? But also, how can I be content in a world that is unsafe for people like me, even if I myself am logically safe? And so partly it's about where do we flee to and where do we choose to be, and, you know, safety and unsafety and... A flat landscape binds all of these questions up in it, because, and all of these different feelings and sentiments of depression and refuge, but also I think most of all the way that those things are the same, but also exemplifies the fact that what is unattractive, the real is unattractive, real things, real life is unattractive, but I would rather feel real than be happy. It's a version of what Sarah Ahmed says in the Promise of Happiness. Perhaps girls would rather be educated than be happy. You know, she says, well, girls are often kept away from education because it's better not to know things, because then you can just be happy. Whereas if you know, education just makes you unhappy. But it's better to know things than to be happy. And the flat place feels like a kind of symbolic site to me of being brought up against the surface of the real, the kind of things that other people don't want to know about, the things it's easier to go about your day if you don't think about.
So, yeah, sometimes that's a refuge, sometimes it's a comfort, sometimes it's a deeply depressing thing, sometimes it's horrific, but it feels real.
What I'm thinking about as you're talking is, well, for one thing, Maggie Tulliver from The Mill on the Floss,
yes,
which I think
exactly.
is the very text that's being talked about the, when Sarah's talking about the education
Perfect.
Of girls.
Yes.
But I'm also thinking of the novelist Jeanette Winterson
yep.
and her memoir, Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal,
yep,
which was her
exactly.
adopted mother's great phrase. But the other thing that she says in the introduction to her best-known book, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, is that she likes to read life in spirals, and she always regards herself as a fictionalised person.
Oh,
and
that's so interesting.
I thought that perhaps you think of yourself as a fiction as well.
Oh, I think we are. Also, there's so many interesting things to say in response to that, and I can't. And so I can't remember the context in which Winterson says that. But isn't it a great phrase? So I'm probably responding to this in a very uninformed way. But my first response is that we are all fictions, right? We're all fictions to ourselves. We're sort of stories that we make up. Other people, you know, I worry a lot in the book about the question of what it is to see other people as real. And there's increasingly I'm understanding that nobody is ever real to anyone else. We are all just stories. Other people are always just kind of, ooh, sorry. We're walking along and I'm looking at interesting rocks as we go, and
well,
I thought that was
one.
A fossil, but it's actually, I think, just a stone with ruts in it. Sorry, apologies.
So you're going to chuck it away? That doesn't
yeah.
doesn't qualify
it doesn't
as collecting.
Qualify. So yeah, the idea that you can almost lift a burden from yourself. Other people can never be fully, perfectly real to anybody else. So one has to be kind to oneself and, of course, to other people. You know, other people will never understand you, and that's okay, because no one ever understands anybody else. But another facet of that question about being a fictionalised person, my life has not felt real since the age of 16. I'm 34 now, nearly 35. And everything since the age of 16 has been better. Everything since the age of 18, when I was accepted to Oxford, has been like a beautiful fairy tale. And of course this doesn't feel real. This is just fictitious, and it makes me kind of reckless because it's not real. I can do whatever I like, you know? So in that sense, yeah, definitely I feel like everything since, for more than half of my life has been a kind of fantastic bedtime story somebody's telling me.
There's a beautiful bit in the book. It's very poignant, it's very sad, and it makes you weep. When you finally tell your friends, you go on a trip with them to the Fens, and you finally tell your friends the story of your
yeah.
flight from Pakistan with your mother and sisters as you've been banished by your frightening father. But as you tell them the story, and you become emotional,
yeah.
they are obviously electrified with the shock of it. But even then you say to them, you know, what I've just told you, is that a story? As though
yeah.
you're just checking whether it even qualifies
yes.
as one.
Yeah. Is that what counts as a story, right? And it's quite funny in the reception of the book, how people often, you know, people have generally been so kind. Of course, there are always some people who say, but I didn't really understand what happened. I felt that the events were left obscure. And what they're complaining about there is that it's not a proper story because they don't know what happened. So that's the sort of, I guess that's the kind of, the feeling at the heart of it, that does this count as a story? Because it's got no climax, no turning point, no... Sorry, nearly fell over there on the Severn beach mud. No good explanations. You know, a story is something... People have particular expectations of story, but the stories of people of colour and people who live outside the global north don't follow those patterns very often, and so they're not comprehensible as stories, and so they don't get told.
Also, people have an unpleasant interest in the kind of denouement of certain
Absolutely.
Stories. I interviewed Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, about the fact that he is, in fact, a 9/11 survivor, although most
oh,
people
gosh.
Don't know that because
no.
he doesn't talk about it. And he said to me that the reason he doesn't talk about it is, if it's ever mentioned, he says he feels people leaning
oh,
in,
awful,
saying,
awful.
Oh, you were there.
Oh,
and
gosh.
He says, suddenly I become interesting.
Yeah.
And he absolutely recoils from
That's
that, is disgusted by that.
Yeah. Yep.
Were you conscious of that when you were writing your book, that actually you didn't want to be interesting in that sense?
I knew the ways in which it would be tempting for people to categorise me. I knew that it would be tempting for particularly the right-wing press, if the right-wing press were ever deigned to be interested in me, unfortunately they haven't, in making this, assuming that it was, no matter what I said, assuming that it was a story, of one of these many stories about how you know, a British woman goes to like Iran or Pakistan or Iraq and there's a terrible time and is abused and then flees, and Britain is good and Pakistan is bad and Islam is bad and atheism or Christianity are good. And that absolutely was not the story. It's not real. And it's not the story I wanted to tell. And it's not, it's got nothing to, you know, my father was abusive because he was an Anglophile. Not because he was a Muslim, yet because he wanted to be more British or to perform a certain, like, exaggerated version of Britishness or atheism. That's what made him a bad father. But I know that you are really, nobody bothers, in the same way that nobody listens to Sweet Thatcher, but I think people particularly are bad at listening to marginalised people and racialised people. They assume they know what you're going to say before you say it. And so I had to be really, I was really careful about that. And it's something I return to over and over again in the book, because I have a responsibility there. I'm not going to be roped in as a right-wing talking point.
Do you ever despair of the medium that you're using, words? I'm just thinking of Virginia Woolf, who says in her diaries at one point, I just wish I could write the waves as farmyard noises. Oh. And just dispense with words altogether.
Oh, do you know what? That's a very interesting question, because what I found that I've been doing recently as a complete amateur, and not interested in being anything but an amateur, but just enjoying it, I've been enjoying making visual art in a really bad way. So, you know, sometimes I do have a feeling or an experience which I think words don't serve, and then I make some very bad visual art, and that exorcises it. So I made, in August and September this year, I didn't let anyone into my flat because it was all covered with paper, and I made a 14 canvas collage and embroidery series of representing the Stations of the Cross, a kind of reinterpretation of the Stations of the Cross, that, you know, what you often get in a kind of Catholic cathedral, the kind of 14 images of Christ on the way to the cross and his death and his resurrection. And so that was wonderful. It took me 6 weeks. I took lots of photographs of myself and other things and embroidered over them. I used some of my cat's ashes and stuck them on the canvas. I cut up notes that my friends had written me. I printed out photographs of my father and embroidered over them. It's been really lovely. Aren't we lucky to have so many ways of making art? And if one fails, we have other choices. But I think, I'm more interested in making things than I am in an audience. Like, I think that, I feel really weird about writing when I don't have anything to write about, or just writing because I am quote unquote a writer. I think one should make something when there's something that won't leave you alone. I think that's a good reason to make something, and to make it in the best way to make it.
What do you think the role of beauty is in your work? The reason I ask is because I made a piece of work, and an art critic saw it, and his only question was, it was a 4 metre long, bizarre, knotted, wrinkled up carpet, knotted with a hand-printed text of a novel.
Amazing.
Looped into it. And all the art critic said was, well, why haven't you made it ugly?
What?
And I said, I'm sorry. He said, well, it's beautiful. What's the point in that? So I'm really, really curious at the moment about what function beauty plays, or what offends people about beauty, if indeed it were beautiful. I mean, you could argue, looking at that carpet that I made, that it's not beautiful because it's deliberately flawed. But what's the objection to beauty, and what role do you think it plays in your work?
I mean, the first thing to say to that, it sounds like the art critic was sort of working through something themselves, which really had nothing to do with your work. But the second thing is, I don't think we suspect beauty when it comes from men. It's just when women, you know, when it's the part of this constant dilemma, isn't it? When men make something beautiful, it's because they're gifted. When women make something beautiful, particularly, it's textile, your work? Mm. That's just handicraft. You know, and therefore it doesn't have artistic value. Like, people always find a way to warp what women do to make it valueless, and there is no kind of set of objective values you bring to it. That's really made me cross. I'm cross on your behalf. And it's a ridiculous thing to say. Beauty is incredibly, it's important to me beauty for me is the creation of a particular feeling, and in the way that I want it to. It's that old thing, isn't it? To be pretty is to be harmonious and kind of pleasing to the eye. To be beautiful is to cause trouble in a way that you can't resolve. I don't know, that's my, I think my personal definition of what I find beautiful. I find lots of, I suppose, technically quite ugly things beautiful, in the same way I find flat landscapes or bones beautiful.
You were sort of clutching at your stomach then, so there's something embedded
there.
Yes,
that's where it happens, right? That's where that's for me. That's where everything gets stored.
That sense of agitation when something shifts.
When something shifts, my abdomen indexes my memories and absent memories. You know, like things. There are lots of things, lots of memories that I don't have access to, but I know that there's something there because my stomach has a reaction. Or, you know, yeah, it's very embodied, right? But I think it is so, on the level of the sentence, to come back to the question of beauty, it is so important to me that every sentence has the weight and the place that I want it. And this doesn't need to be a harmonious placement. It can often and should often be a surprising placement. So I think a lot about, so not just the rhythm of the sentence, but the kind of, I want every sentence in my writing to wake up the reader a little bit. So an example of this I often think about is, I'm in Orkney, I was writing about Orkney, and I wrote about the axe cold sea. And my wonderful editor just double checked, was like, are you sure you didn't mean the ice cold sea yet then? I said, no, I definitely meant axe cold. I wanted to be almost ice cold, but not quite. I wanted something odd to happen. I wanted there to be a disruption. That to me is beauty. That to me, you know, to have an ice cold sea is barely even pretty, but to have an axe cold sea, that to me is beautiful. And also I don't care what other people think is beautiful. The only thing that matters to me is whether I think it's beautiful. Whether I think it's beautiful. I can't buy presents for other people. I'm so bad at it because I can never understand, I can never imagine myself into other people's heads and think, oh, they'll find that beautiful. I can only think, well, if I do that, it goes really wrong, and I and I come up with something really terrible and monstrous. I'm not able to predict what other people will find beautiful. So all I can do is be really as honest as I can about making things beautiful on my own terms. And that's not everybody's cup of tea, but it doesn't have to be.
Although flat places shimmer and shift in this book, there's one, the first we meet, which seems to stay the same shape. It's in Lahore. At least it was when Noreen was a child and being driven to school.
How could there be so much empty land in the middle of crowded, parched, shouting Lahore? How could anything be so deeply, achingly green? I felt that green on my skin and in my dry throat. The school playground never kept its grass more than a few days. Every year it was re-sown optimistically, the seeds sending up dark, dusty tufts, as though Lahore might decide to change its climate. But within days the ground had baked solid and brown, under the blasting sun and the thousands of small feet in shiny black shoes. Not those fields. Through summer sun, monsoon downpour and winter mists, and the spring whose creeping heat I experienced like the sound of a distant sinister drum, they stayed lush. I kept my stare fixed on that beautiful alien colour as the trees flicked past the window, a long row of trunks lining the road, which measured out my journey to school as rhythmically as a heartbeat. The fields were perfectly, shimmeringly flat. No people crossed them. No hills, no valleys, no machinery. There was nothing for the eye to light on. Good, I thought. My gaze didn't want to be distracted. It wanted to fly and fly like a bird skimming the grass without stopping. I imagined picking up every inch of ground and storing that expanse inside me for when I needed it. Later, standing on the edge of the school playground, watching the flies cluster by my feet, or staring blankly at my teacher's face in the classroom, I could take myself back to the fields and live there in the cool quiet by myself. Everything in my Lahore was cramped. Five of us shared a bedroom, four of us shared the back seat. So that expansive emptiness seemed impossible, like a glimpse of the divine. I could send my eyes running off over the fields, even as I stayed jammed in the back seat of the car, against my little sister forget-me-not, my hands up against the glass. Don't touch the glass, my mother said from the front seat. It leaves a smear that never comes off. Running in my mind faster than was possible, stretching my muscles as hard as they could possibly be stretched. In that space, no matter how I moved, if I flung myself or rolled or cartwheeled, I didn't know how to cartwheel. I knew I wouldn't come up against anything. If I walked far enough, I thought, over those fields, out past the edges of my vision, soon the road and the car and my fighting sisters would vanish, and there would just be me. Standing in the middle of that flatness, turning slowly, with nothing to see on any side. Then, maybe, I could rest.
Noreen and I walk back to the railway station, thick mud clinging to our boots. I wave her off and wonder if there will be a time when she can rest. But even when a landscape looks flat, who knows what might be seething, roiling, unseeable under the ground. This is a restless book, and its flat plains and smooth pages suggest a riot of unseen territory underneath.